Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org. This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. It feels like a light at the end of the tunnel. The COVID-19 vaccines are getting into more arms. Over a dozen states are opening up vaccine eligibility to all adults this week. And President Biden gave a hopeful glimpse into the future.
By April 19th, 3 weeks from today, 90% of adults, people over 18 and over, will be eligible to get vaccinated. 90% of all Americans will be living within 5 miles of a place they can get a shot.
But the fight is far from over. The Biden administration is in a vaccination race against rising cases in the U.S. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky said she has a feeling of impending doom about a potential fourth wave. It's confusing and can leave you with a lot of questions. That's why we're here to get answers in another installment of Vaccination Nation. Here to answer your questions is Angela Rasmussen. She's a virologist and an affiliate at the Georgetown University Center for Global Health Science and Security. Angela, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me, Jen.
We also have Dr. Lena Nguyen with us. She's an emergency physician and visiting professor at George Washington University. She's also the former Baltimore City Health Commissioner and author of the forthcoming book, Lifelines, A Doctor's Journey in the Fight for Public Health. Dr. Nguyen, thanks for being here.
Great to join you. Thank you.
So, Angela, according to the CDC, the 7-day average of new cases is just under 62,000, which is a 12% increase from the prior week. Why are we seeing a rise in cases right now?
So I think that one of the reasons we're seeing a rise in cases is that many states have lifted the mitigation measures that were in place, at least partially, measures such as mask mandates, reopening indoor dining and other indoor businesses, and making more opportunities, basically, for people to mingle with people who are outside of their households. I think that this was done a little prematurely. We really should have had more people vaccinated before we started to relax some of those restrictions. And then on top of that, we also know that some of the variants, which are known to be more transmissible, are increasing in prevalence in the communities and in our communities. And those two factors have really created an environment in which a lot of new infections can occur.
Now, Dr. Nguyen, Andy Slavitt, White House senior advisor for the COVID-19 response, said this week that 50% of all seniors have now been vaccinated. Hospitals have also reported seeing younger people with severe infections. What kind of shift in the population are we seeing right now, and how is that driving cases?
Well, the good news here is that we do have the older population vaccinated in large numbers. The numbers are now about 50% of people over 65 are now fully vaccinated, and over 70% of those over 65 have received at least one shot, which is really fantastic news. In a way, the shift that we're now seeing to younger people being hospitalized indicates that vaccines are working because the older individuals are now protected as a result of vaccination. But we're also seeing pretty disturbing trends. In Michigan, as an example, people in their 30s, the rise in hospitalization in that group is about 600% in the last month or so. For people in their 40s, about 800% increase in the rate of hospitalization. And so I think this is a warning, exactly as Angie was saying, about the importance of continuing to keep up our guard. I think that there is a tendency to now say, look, everybody's getting vaccinated. This is great, except we are not yet at the point that everybody is vaccinated. We are increasing those numbers every single day. We're now getting 2.5 million doses into arms every day. That's fantastic. But we're not nearly at the point that we can be letting down our guard, and we need to keep up masking and, very importantly, avoiding indoor gatherings.
And where are we in the race against variants?
Well, I think that we are, the race of three things, because we typically talk about the race of vaccines versus variants. We do have this more concerning B.1.1.7 variant, the variant coming from the UK, that is becoming dominant here in the US. And that certainly is driving much of the surge. But there's the other component that Professor Rasmussen talked about, which is human behavior. It is lifting of restrictions, mask mandates. The fact that so many states have now lifted their mask mandates, it's really the the wrong time to be doing that, and it's setting us back in this race.
Angela, what do we know about whether our current vaccines are effective against the variants we've seen so far?
Well, we still are learning this, and this is a very active area of research. But actually, this morning, we just got some very good news from Pfizer showing that the Pfizer vaccine, at least, retains efficacy against the B1351 variant. That was the one originally discovered in South Africa. There has been a suggestion that that variant, as well as the P1 variant first discovered in Brazil, have mutations in a part of the spike protein that can make the vaccines potentially less effective. But it looks like those vaccines are holding their own, and they are at least keeping people out of the hospital, even if they aren't as efficacious at preventing symptomatic COVID-19 overall. So I think that we're still in good shape, but it is imperative to make sure that as many people can get vaccinated as possible. We also had some very good news come from the CDC earlier this week that showed that the vaccines, at least the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, are very, very protective against infection as well as disease, with as much as 80% protection 2 weeks after the first shot. So that's fantastic news. That means that basically, if we can get a lot of people vaccinated, the variants, as well as all of the viruses that are circulating, all of the SARS coronavirus 2 that's circulating right now in the U.S., will have a less hospitable population of potential hosts. That means that over time, if we can get more people vaccinated, there will be a lower likelihood of new variants emerging on top of the ones we're already dealing with.
Well, there was some other news. The Pfizer vaccine was found safe for younger teenagers, young people aged 12 to 15. And Angela, you wrote an op-ed column about the importance of vaccinating children. Why do you see urgency in vaccinating kids?
Well, I see urgency because of what I was just talking about. I think that in the short term, or the medium term anyways, it's fantastic that we'll be able to vaccinate 12 to 15-year-olds. That means that they'll be able to enjoy that same level of protection when they return to school in the fall. But we will still have a large population of younger kids than that who aren't going to be vaccinated, assuming that the majority of the adult population and the older pediatric population are all getting vaccinated. That means that the virus isn't really going to have anywhere to go except those younger kids. So it is important long term to make sure that, again, we're not providing the virus with a pool of susceptible hosts to vaccinate everybody, regardless of age, going forward. And the good news there is that trials for both Moderna and Pfizer have started in children aged 6 months to 11 years old. So once that data comes in, I think we'll be in really good shape in terms of vaccinating the entire population and getting that much closer to the herd immunity threshold.
Dr. Nguyen, since kids haven't been vaccinated yet, what should parents do if they get vaccinated but their children aren't?
Yeah, this is part of that tricky territory, because you would not be considered to have a fully vaccinated household if the parents are vaccinated, but the children, understandably, are not yet. And so I would still urge caution. And what I mean is that we know that if that fully vaccinated people can get together with one another, but not if you have this mixed household. And so if you have grandparents that are fully vaccinated, they can come and visit one household. So they can visit the parents and grandchildren. But I would not recommend for multiple households that have multiple unvaccinated children to be mixing. So I would still encourage those individuals to see one another outdoors with households spaced at least 6 feet apart. And I realize this is difficult, but at the same time, we have spring and summer now coming. And so I think that we can enjoy Easter weekend, Passover, and other things. But if there are multiple people who are unvaccinated in different households, I would still see one another outdoors only.
Sharon tweets, received Moderna and had reactions both times, but nothing severe. Putting up with a sore arm, nausea, and a headache for a couple of days beats the heck out of getting coronavirus. I'm grateful. And Tina tweets, I lucked into mine at my internist's office. I was there for a regular checkup for an underlying condition. I burst into tears when she told me she had one last J&J to give that day, and it was mine. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
we as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
On NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we talk about TV, movies, and more, like the new Marvel Disney Plus series, The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, and a definitive ranking of the best Muppets. All of that in around 20 minutes every weekday. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
We're answering as many of your questions as we can about vaccines and the vaccine rollout. Well, Gigi asks, given how little COVID-19 affects young kids, do they even need to get vaccinated? What age would be best to give a first dose based on what we know now? Dr. Nguyen?
Well, right now, the Pfizer vaccine is approved, or rather is given emergency use authorization for children 16 and older. That's the only vaccine that's currently authorized for that 16 and older category. Younger children, as was just mentioned, are not yet eligible to receive the vaccine, although we hope that kids in the 12 and older category will be able to be vaccinated in late summer, maybe early fall. Even younger children, probably we're not going to be able to vaccinate them until early 2022. And so I'd say that the answer to Gigi's question still is to be determined. Although I will say that as the mother of almost 1-year-old and a 3.5-year-old, I cannot wait for the day that I can vaccinate them, or that they can be vaccinated so that the entire family could enjoy the protection that the vaccines offer.
Well, and Gigi asked why, if young kids are not as severely impacted by the virus, why they need to be vaccinated at all?
Great question. Two reasons. One is that children can still get ill and have become ill. Very sadly, there have been several thousand children who have this multi-system inflammatory syndrome that's quite severe, and children have died because of coronavirus. So it is in part to protect them. But the other reason is to protect others around us as well. It will be very difficult for us to reach herd immunity if we cannot vaccinate our children. And I thought that that Angie had written a great op-ed describing this as a major reason too for why we need to have our children vaccinated.
We heard from the CDC director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, and she dropped some big news.
Our data from the CDC today suggests, that vaccinated people do not carry the virus, don't get sick, and that it's not just in the clinical trials, but it's also in real world data.
Angela, what does this mean for how vaccinated people should conduct themselves? Should they still be wearing masks?
So this means that as more people get vaccinated, we can start relaxing those mask requirements and those mitigation measures. The data that Dr. Walensky is referring to there was what I mentioned a little bit earlier. It was a report done in healthcare workers, testing them periodically over time after they had been vaccinated. And what that showed was that after 2 weeks after the first shot, people are 80% less likely to contract COVID, to become infected with SARS coronavirus 2. After the second shot and completing that vaccine regimen, that moves up to a 90% reduction in risk of being infected. So that means that the vast, vast majority of people who are vaccinated will also be protected from being infected at all. That's fantastic news. And that means that ultimately, yes, we will be able to completely relax and go back to living a quote unquote normal life. But it's not 100% risk reduction. So for now, while we still have a lot of unvaccinated people in the population, even vaccinated people should continue to wear masks when they are out in public spaces. Now at home, that's a different story. When they're gathering with family members, perhaps, or friends, if everybody's vaccinated, no problem. If people are not moving around among a bunch of different households with a lot of unvaccinated people, no problem. But until we get the majority of the adult population at least vaccinated, people should continue to take precautions, especially in public spaces where you don't know what other people's vaccine status might be.
One of you tweets this: are there booster jabs for all the strains popping up? Angela, what do we know right now?
So there are booster booster shots that have been developed for the new variants, and they are currently in clinical trials. Both Pfizer and Moderna are trying different combinations of those boosters. I believe that in one trial, they are just looking at using a booster for the B117 variant. It may also include some of the mutations from the B1351 variant. And in another trial, they're looking at a combination of mRNAs that are encoding the original variant as well as the new variant. So I think that we're going to have a lot more information as these trials continue and as they read out and complete. But the bottom line is, you know, we know that these vaccines are incredibly safe and effective in real-world conditions. So it's very, very likely that booster shots, which are basically just reformulated, the sequence of the mRNA encoding the spike protein is tweaked just a little bit. It's like going through a document and changing a couple words, essentially. But the point of the document remains the same. We have every reason to think that those boosters will be effective and that that will allow us to rapidly and flexibly adjust our vaccinations as the need arises in the future.
Well, Dr. Nguyen, recently the CDC changed guidelines for schools. Now they say rather than keeping 6 feet apart, students can be 3 feet. And you wrote about this idea of risk management and how guidelines can change. Why is 3 feet now okay for schools?
I think it's not so much that 3 feet is suddenly fine as opposed to 6 feet in the past, but rather that we have to recognize as a society that a year into the pandemic, that in-person schooling is absolutely essential. And in order for that to happen, we can't keep this 6 foot requirement because many schools are not going to be able to open full time if we keep the 6 foot requirement. And so my point in the recent op-eds I've been writing for the Post is we really need to switch our mentality from thinking about if something is safe, because we're never going to agree to the degree of safety. Nothing is 100% safe. Nothing is going to be 100% risky. At this point, we need to think about what is absolutely essential. And for those essential activities, we need to do everything possible in order to add layers of mitigation in order to reduce that risk. And so what I mean is, if we now say our goal is to have all of our schools open 100% for in-person instruction, and we recognize that we can't do 6 feet of distancing, then we have to do everything we can to replace that 6 foot distancing with other mitigation layers. That includes vaccinating our teachers and staff. That includes ideally also having regular surveillance testing. Certainly that includes enforcing mask wearing at all times. And so I think that it's a change in mentality. Schools are a good example of this, but I think overall, we really need to change our mentality from how can we get to normalcy as much as we can while also reducing risk.
I want to try to quickly move through some questions that have come in. Elizabeth tweets, please address confusion regarding painkillers. I hear it's not okay to take painkillers before getting vaccinated, but perhaps it's okay to alleviate side effects. And if taking for symptoms after, some say only Tylenol, others say ibuprofen is fine too. Dr. Nguyen, what can you tell us?
Yeah, so this has to do with the theory that's not proven of maybe it's a good thing for your body to be experiencing these symptoms post-vaccination, as in these symptoms that we talk about, the fever, muscle aches, et cetera. There's a theory that maybe you don't want to be blunting those symptoms because that's actually your body's immune response at work. They are correct, whoever is saying that is correct, that these symptoms are normal, they are expected. We don't really know whether taking Tylenol or ibuprofen will affect the immune response, really. And so generally, the recommendation, as the caller was saying, is don't take it before as pre-medication. But if you really need to take it afterwards because you are having severe symptoms, it's fine to do. Both Tylenol and ibuprofen should be fine if you really need it.
Angela, we've been hearing that vaccinations may be helping those experiencing long-haul symptoms. What do we know about that?
So that's a very interesting hypothesis that has been raised primarily by my colleague Akiko Iwasaki at Yale University. And the idea is that when you get a vaccine, you are essentially reprogramming your immune system. So we don't know a lot about what causes long COVID, but it may be, and there is some evidence emerging that it may be due to sort of an aberrant immune response that never really goes away. So when you get COVID, your immune system responds inappropriately and turns on certain parts of the immune system that can leave these lingering chronic conditions as a result. And certainly we know that can happen for some other viruses. It's not really well understood what causes one person to have that aberrant response compared to another. But the idea here is that by giving a vaccine, in which case you are not getting infected with the virus, you are eliciting these immune responses that are helpful for clearing up a viral infection. You're essentially rebooting those abnormal immune responses and potentially going back to normal. As I said, this is just a hypothesis. Mm-hmm. This needs to be tested, but I think it's a very interesting idea, and it would be fantastic if that is true. Then that might mean that all of the people who are really suffering from long COVID, or what's also sometimes called PASC, might have an easy solution and an easy treatment that will actually be good for everybody, because it means that more people are being robustly immunized and will have long-term protection against reinfection.
We'll be back with more from you and our guests in a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A. Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
How is COVID changing the college experience? What's driving the increase in crossings at the border? Why did Colorado's gun laws fail to prevent a mass shooting there? Listen for answers, backstory, and analysis beyond the day's headlines on Consider This from NPR.
Now let's get back to our conversation about the state of vaccines in the nation. Well, we found out that 15 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine were ruined at a Baltimore plant manufacturer. And Pat from Florida wants to know, are those folks who already received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine protected and safe from spoilage? Were any doses from that plant distributed, and did they end up in arms? Dr. Nguyen, what do we know?
Yeah, this is a great question and really important to clarify. So the doses that are already distributed here in the U.S. came from a plant in Europe, and so did not come from this plant in question at all. And so for all those people, including myself, who've received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, there is no problem. You should not be concerned. That said, I do think that it is a setback to have potentially up to 15 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine being delayed here in the U.S. as a result of this plant issue. And so it, again, is a setback, but I think people should feel assured that this is why we have a regulatory process. It's actually a good thing that that this problem was caught. Again, people should be reassured that the vaccines that are already in circulation here in the U.S. are just fine.
Well, let's turn to a voicemail. This came in from Rod in Illinois.
I just was wanting to know the best way to go about vaccine misinformation in rural America. Here in Illinois, a lot of our downstate vaccine sites have a surplus of vaccine just because the rural residents, including doctors and nurses, are refusing it. And many of their qualms are things that they've read about on Facebook that aren't based in scientific fact. So any tips, tricks, or pointers would be great.
We also heard from someone who said she has major concerns about the vaccines because she says they're experimental and may cause long-term side effects. Angela, how are you addressing misinformation about vaccines and people who distrust the shots?
This is a really tough question, and I'm not sure that I or anybody else has the single answer for this. but I'll do my best. I think that this is really something that needs to be dealt with in a multi-pronged way. I think that on one hand, it's very important for people to be able to talk to trusted messengers. There hasn't been enough of that where people in the medical and scientific communities are really talking to people, listening to their concerns, and addressing those. I think that social media companies also need to do a better job of preventing this type of misinformation from spreading, because if somebody doesn't have a trusted source that they can access to ask those questions, then Facebook or Twitter or other social media sites will really fill in that gap and can provide this misinformation. It is a real problem, without a doubt, and there are people who are also intentionally spreading this type of misinformation. The anti-vaccine movement is very organized, and they're very good at what they do. But in my personal experience, I think that one of the best things that I can do personally is to just make myself available to answer people's questions. When I had that op-ed out earlier this week in the New York Times, I spent a lot of time on Twitter just calmly answering the questions that were being raised, even if they were, you know, really not based in anything scientific. I think that it's incredibly important for scientists, for physicians, for medical providers to listen to people, to hear where they're coming from, to hear what their concerns are, and to address those seriously and honestly. There are good reasons to have questions about these vaccines. And I think for many of them, we do have answers. And with regard to the vaccines being experimental, it's true that right now they are available via an emergency use authorization because this is indeed a public health emergency. But Pfizer also announced this morning that they have sufficient follow-up data to apply for full FDA approval. So I hope that as this moves forward, as we collect more data on the vaccines, we'll have more information to share with people who do have questions, who may be hesitant or skeptical of their value. And hopefully we can win some hearts and minds just by engaging with people in an honest and serious manner.
Well, Christine tweets, how effective is the COVID vaccine in immune compromised persons? My doc told me people with compromised immune systems have less protection from the vaccine itself than the general population. Dr. Nguyen?
And I would say the answer is it depends. And to clarify this, because I think sometimes people think, well, individuals who are immunocompromised, maybe they shouldn't take the vaccine because somehow it's not going to work on them in some way. Actually, it's quite the opposite. People with immunocompromise, because they are more susceptible to severe outcomes from COVID-19, they should definitely take the vaccine. They are individuals who are at most risk and so should definitely get the vaccine. This vaccine also does not contain live virus, and so it does not cause harm to the individual who is immunocompromised. That said, depending on what type of immunosuppression someone has, it is possible and even likely that the vaccine may not result in as robust of an immune response in them as they would in somebody who does not have a compromised immune system. And so I think the best thing to do is to speak with your doctor and get the vaccine, but also know that if you are immunocompromised, that you may need to continue to keep up a number of other precautions even after getting the vaccine.
We got this question from Crystal, who tweets, have there been any updates on information or guidance for those who have had allergic reactions? I had an immediate allergic reaction to my first shot, and my doctor does not recommend I take the second. Angela, what can you tell us for people like Crystal?
So it is not unheard of for people to have allergic reactions to different components that are in vaccines. For that reason, for example, every time you go in for an influenza shot every year, you will be asked if you have an allergy to eggs. And that's because that particular vaccine has been grown in chicken eggs in many cases. For these vaccines, they're not grown in eggs, so egg allergies are not a problem. But they are composed of different ingredients, some of which can provoke allergic reactions in people. But the good news is that allergic reactions are very, very rare. They're also very, very treatable. So for this reason, many vaccine providers for the COVID vaccines have asked people to remain on site for 30 minutes after they get vaccinated, and people will be asked, and I just scheduled my first vaccine appointment today, they will be asked if they have a history of allergic reactions, severe allergic reactions to vaccines or other medications. So I think that, you know, there is a system in place to try to identify people who might be at a higher risk of this. But overall, the incidence of severe allergic reactions are actually pretty low. It's very rare for this to happen. And as I mentioned, it's treatable. So I think that if somebody's physician advises them to not get a vaccine because of this history, then they should not. And definitely always go with what your provider is suggesting to you based on your own medical history. This is actually why we need to make sure that as many people get vaccinated as possible. The herd immunity threshold will protect people who can't get vaccines because of allergic reactions or other medical contraindications for being vaccinated. So the bottom line is, if you can get vaccinated, please do so to provide protection for those people who can't.
Well, we got this email from Suzanne who says, what is the duration of immunity after vaccination?
So that we don't know. That is unfortunately one of those things that we can't really press fast forward on a clinical trial and look into the future and see how long antibody and immune response durability lasts. So really the only way to determine that is to follow the people in the clinical trials and wait and see how long they are protected. Now, the good news is for all of the clinical trials that are going on, those continue even after FDA approval is granted or emergency use authorization. And this is normally how the vaccine process works. A vaccine can be approved, but people who receive it will be followed for years to determine when, if necessary, a booster shot should be given to bump up that immune response. So we don't know, but right now, we do have some data from the earliest clinical trials that suggest that at least antibody responses are maintained for a period of at least 9 months and probably longer. So I would imagine that we're not going to be needing a booster shot every year for our COVID vaccines indefinitely. Once the virus stops circulating, we should all have relatively durable immunity that might require occasional boosters, but not all the time.
Well, we're getting lots of questions about what happens post-vaccination. Paul tweets, I'm a senior and fully vaccinated. My housemate is vaccinated, but works at the supermarket. Should we wear masks at home when in the same room? Dr. Nguyen?
Well, as I so based on the situation that you're talking about, it sounds like one of you is vaccinated and the other one is not. Is that correct?
Oh, no, they're both fully vaccinated, but one works at a supermarket.
Oh, I see. Well, if you're both vaccinated, I would say that you are both very well protected. I would not wear masks at home. And I would say that you're also able to get together with other fully vaccinated people. Of course, you should continue to wear masks when out in public, when you're around unvaccinated individuals. But if you're both fully vaccinated, that's fantastic. And I am looking forward to the day when my household and all other households will be able to enjoy that too.
Brooke emailed, my husband and I disagree on whether to enroll our children in the Moderna vaccine trial in our area. They're healthy, ages 7 and 10. Is it a good idea or just wait it out?
Well, I think with 7 and 10-year-olds, I would first ask the kids if they want to participate. But certainly, I think that this is going to be something that nobody can really answer for any parent. I think that people need to decide how comfortable they are with the risks and decide if they want to enroll their kids. And the good news is, I think there are probably a lot of people who want to enroll their kids. So even if their kids aren't enrolled, we will still be able to get that data.
That's Angela Rasmussen, a virologist and affiliate at the Georgetown University Center for Global Health Science and Security. Also with us, Dr. Lena Nguyen, emergency physician and visiting professor at George Washington University Milken Institute School of Public Health. Thanks to you both for tackling all our questions today. Today's producer was Michelle Harvin. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.